This is the fourth class that we're doing. Someone asked whether they are sequential, and they're really not. You could be coming in fresh today, and it isn't necessary to have been here the last couple of days to kind of make sense of what we're doing. The series we're calling Into the Labyrinth, the Middle East After the Gulf War. Today's session is Prospects for Palestinian-Israeli Reconciliation. By way of introduction, I work in Seattle with an international education organization and teach on the Middle East part-time when I can, but I spend a lot of my time with English language education and international students. My wife, Anne, has studied Middle East history and Persian and has lived in Kuwait for a year when we went there. So it's nice to see you all here today, and I guess probably you're thinking maybe today you'll finally figure out what in the world is going on in the Middle East, you know, in the Palestinian-Israeli situation. And actually, I think we're at a pretty good point to see some light at the end of the tunnel right now. I mean, historically, if you look at the expanse of history, it's been a pretty grim history. And I don't know, I feel more positive now about the Middle Eastern situation than I have in a long time. Doesn't mean to say that I was real happy about the Gulf War, but in the fallout after the Gulf War, what I can see coming is some significant change. And there are a lot of different reasons for it. But one of the real positive things that may be coming out of it is that, in a sense, a certain sense of realism has set in for all parties. And that perhaps, as a result of that realism, the various parties who have, to this point, been kind of on an extreme position, saying, well, we're not negotiating unless, you know, we get the whole pie on one side or the other, are saying now, well, we may have to live with something less than the whole pie. And because of that willingness to begin to negotiate, and perhaps because the U.S. is putting a lot of pressure on the various sides, there may be a possibility for accommodation. So before we get on into the meat of the session, I do want to mention a couple of books or resources. One is Whose Promised Land? By Colin Chapman. This is a Christian man from, I think, Britain. I'm not sure what his nationality is. But he spent many, many years in the Middle East, and he's written Whose Promised Land? And let's see, who's published this? It's been around for quite a while. A Lion paperback, Lion Publishing in England. But remember the title. You may be able to come across this somewhere. And he gives some of the historical background and kind of looking at the issue from both sides. Israel or Palestine, who does it belong to? What are the claims and counterclaims? Are the ancient promises of the Bible relevant today? Is there a way forward? So he tries to deal with some of the basic issues. Something I ran across in Seattle that gave me kind of a different perspective on issues there is called Journal of Palestine Studies. Now, by the title, you can assume that it's not pro-Israeli. And there are both pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian publications. This one, which is sympathetic to the Palestinians, nevertheless, tries to document what's happening there during the Intifada, which in the West, we don't get a lot of information about what the Palestinian people are thinking, what's happening in their own sort of inner circle. And that, I think, is kind of interesting. The Western press tends to give sort of the governmental perspective on things. And I always, as a student of the Middle East, I always kind of like to know what the thinkers are thinking, what the teachers are teaching, what the people are talking about. Now, these are just two resources, and really one should try to get a broad range of resources, because there isn't any one that's going to give you a fully objective view. I wouldn't consider this fully objective, but it is interesting. And the other thing is that it's current. It comes out regularly. And with the Middle East, you know, you have to get current information because things are changing all the time. At this point, before any other comments, we want to make sure to give an opportunity for comments and questions. Is there anything you wanted to say at this point?
No.
Okay. any comments or questions right off the bat? I'd like to kind of know where you're at today.
The Palestinian, he's native to this area, isn't he?
Well, it just so happens I was going to start off with who are the Palestinians. So that's a good place to start. So that's kind of a fundamental question. Any other, and we'll touch on that, any other comments right off the bat, things that are on your mind, so that I can get a sense of that?
That book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, doesn't that give a good perspective? He was a Jewish, the author is Jewish, but seeing that he wasn't anti-Palestinian or pro-Jewish either.
Yeah, I've heard positive comments about the book, and I have scanned through it. It's in the bookstore. Got to plug those books in the bookstore. Any other of those, did you pick up one of those concise histories of the Middle East? Oh, anybody see if there's any left?
There's one by Lippmann. Is that the one you read?
No, that's another one. That's Understanding Islam.
A small one.
Well, it's a nice little sort of summary of Islam, yeah, Understanding Islam. And Beirut to Jerusalem is kind of an interesting perspective. I think it's like a journalist describing what he sees, yeah.
It helped me understand why those people can't get together in the
right.
Arabs, but they hate each other.
Yeah, I like the books that get in there and describe what it's like on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Those are good because it gives you a sense of the personalities involved. The danger is that a Westerner reading a book by a Westerner tends to come away from the region feeling like it's hopeless. You know, there's not. It's sort of the feeling of, well, you just can't work with these people. You know, they're all irrational. I mean, this is what tends to come out of Western written stuff, and that's why my first impulse is to say, now, what are the Middle Eastern people thinking? You know, so as many books as are written by Western people, a lot of them tend to read well in the West, but I'm not always sure that they give us a sense of, well, now, do Middle Eastern people have reasons for what they do, or are they just irrational? You know, and I tend to think they are rational. I tend to think Middle Eastern people have reasons, but they're conflicting reasons and conflicting positions.
I was moved by a book I read some years ago called Blood Brothers.
Uh-huh. Elias Shakur.
Uh-huh. Yes. Is that out of date now?
No, I wouldn't think so. It's fairly recent.
Yes, he's writing from his own experience,
sure,
as an Arab.
Yeah, he's a Palestinian Christian.
Christian Arab.
Which in Western thinking is an oxymoron. You know, Palestinian Christian? Gee. Yeah, it is a very interesting perspective.
He did a lot personally himself.
Right.
Of course, he's from his own.
Yes, yes. So I would recommend that. Blood Brothers, yeah. Any other books people want to recommend?
Uh-huh. No, I just, one issue that sort of is still something I don't understand is the issue of Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
How that all fits into the puzzle there.
Right.
Or the home for Palestinians.
Right.
You know, that type of thing.
Right. Well, that's an excellent point. Lebanon is so closely tied in. We tend to think in terms of these national boundaries. We look at the map and we say, okay, that's Lebanon and that's, you know, Israel and that's the West Bank. And so these are these defined units in our mind. But with Middle Eastern people, for thousands of years, they didn't have maps that everybody read and bought in the local bookstore and said, okay, now this is my country's border. You know, it was, well, how much of this region did this particular king or authority control? And they were all integrated in a big fabric. And so, yeah, for their thinking, Lebanon, Israel, Jordan, they're all kind of interconnected in their mind.
Could you specifically during the course of, after you get through the people involved, give a little bit of perspective on the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip in relationship to the people that want that area back? Mm-hmm. I'd like to get your
those specific sections. Uh-huh.
I have two. One was a Judeo-Christian. And it takes the history from the time of Christ to the present, and that has helped me understand, you know, the problems for the Jews in the area,
mm-hmm.
Along with, you know, what's happened with the Christian church in that area.
Mm-hmm.
The other one that I thoroughly enjoy reading is Leon Uris,
mm-hmm.
and I've read innumerable, if mm-hmm. you want to look at it from a novel standpoint. He's done some pretty good work on various aspects.
The Hajj?
The Hajj was great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was. And there's been several others. I'm reading Mileta. Milta Pass.
Mm.
That was one about one of the wars. that's one of the things.
Uh-huh.
I had a neighbor who was Lebanese, but his home was Jerusalem. And that was a little confusing to me for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but because from what he said, his family had lived there in Jerusalem for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And so how did that work in? And maybe this is what you're talking about, no boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
He apparently got his Lebanese identity from where his family originated
mm-hmm.
from.
And that's a real interesting comment on the Middle East. Again, we do tend to think in terms of I'm a citizen of this nation or that nation, and the concept of a modern nation is kind of new. In the Middle East, for centuries and centuries, your identity was tied into the hometown where you were from, the tribe or the ethnic group that you were associated with, rather than, you know, a citizenship in a certain nation. And that's a very different way of thinking. You know, you're a Yakiman, you know. And you don't necessarily care that much who controls the larger territory. That's some empire. But you're a Yakiman. I mean, that's your identity, see? And that's kind of how they think. That's right. And so they might live in Beirut. Their family might have been there for decades, but they're still from some little town in northern Lebanon, in reality. And so they go out there for holidays and visit the family house and stuff. Well, let's take a look at who are the people there in the region. Yeah, you had a comment?
Yeah, another question. I just wanted to make a statement about the Palestine liberation. And mm-hmm. I don't really understand what they're doing. I mean, are they, is Palestine, show my ignorance, controlled by Israel now, and the Palestinians want it back, or what? I mean, yeah, I don't know what's going on. I'd like a little insight into that.
Okay. So you're interested in the, you want to come on in.
Yeah, like the PLO, what are they about? Right. Why are they doing
what
they're doing?
Right. So PLO specifically, as opposed to just Palestinians in general, and PLO, which is an actual organization, Palestine Liberation Organization, founded in the mid-60s, and Arafat was one of the founders. Yeah, that's a good question. I think we could just maybe raise a lot of questions and then we'd be done today. There's a lot to cover, but I appreciate these great comments and questions. Let's start with looking at who first of all, who's there in the area. The population in Israel is about 4.6 million, 85% are Jewish, 13% Muslim, and 3% Christian. This is the population within the 67 boundaries. And the 67 boundaries does not include the West Bank and Gaza Strip and Golan Heights as far as Israel itself. Those are considered occupied territories. And then you have Jordan on the other side, and Jordan's population is 4.1 million. So, as far as the actual, and half of Jordan's population is Palestinian, that is people who consider themselves from Palestine, the area bordered by the Dead Sea and the Jordan River, and then on the north by southern Lebanon, down into the Negev Desert. Those people whose families lived in that area call themselves Palestinian. And so there are about 2 million Palestinians living in modern-day Jordan. And I couldn't find figures on the West Bank and Gaza Strip, but I'm guessing there's something over a million, probably 1.2 million, 1.4 million Palestinians in those two areas. Are you all clear as to where that is?
Do you want me to point to some of those on that?
Yeah.
This is, unfortunately, it's so tiny.
Kind of small.
So do the borders, the boundaries of Palestine again?
Well, why don't I do it, because, yeah, it could be hard to coordinate. West Bank is right up in this area here. Gaza Strip is down in this area. And the Golan Heights is up in the north, right on the northeastern side of Galilee. And this is a kind of a high hill here, which belonged to Syria, in response to that question. And the reason Israel wants to hang on to the Golan Heights is because Syria had positioned artillery up there and was shelling into Galilee. Mm-hmm. And the West Bank, this territory here, was annexed after the 48 war by Jordan. And so that was called, considered part of Jordan. In any case, you have then several million Palestinians, probably about 2.5 to 3 million Palestinians. So they're more or less equal numbers of Palestinians totally and Jewish Israelis. In Israel, there are Palestinians who are citizens. A Jewish friend of mine maintains that Palestinians in Israel have rights as citizens and can vote and have some parliament members, but I don't think too many people would hold that Palestinians in Israel are fully equal in citizenship in Israel, for the main reason that in order to immigrate to Israel, you, generally speaking, need to be of Jewish descent. Doesn't necessarily mean you have to believe in Judaism, but that you need to be of Jewish descent.
Mm-hmm. Are the Jews in your 67 count there that are in Palestine or in that area now? Are they native to the area? Are they imports from Dispersia?
The diaspora, right. If you go back about 100 years, there were about 200,000, about 100 years ago, there were about 200,000 Jews in the area. And then a lot of them migrated from places like Yemen and Iraq and North Africa, and then a great number came in from Europe as well. So by and large, the majority have migrated into the area. But the population of Palestinians has also increased since that time through the birth rate significantly. About 100 years ago, I think there was about 1.5 million or 1.2 million Palestinians. But, you know, they were all kind of mishmashed together. Everybody spoke Arabic. Hebrew was revived as a language. And so if you go back a couple hundred years, in Palestine, everybody spoke Arabic. And then they might have also spoken either Turkish, because they were Ottomans, or they might have spoken French, because the French controlled Egypt at one time, or they might have spoken English, because the British controlled the area.
What if the useful for you to go back one step and talk about a little bit about the establishment of the state?
Okay.
Okay.
I just like to let things flow, you know. Okay, here we've got a timeline that you'll need to kind of share. One to three people maybe kind of put it between you and look at that. This was for a class we did at our church in the spring. And I thought, well, just to make sure, to get the record straight, and to you know, there's a lot of counterclaims about who was there first. So I thought, well, I'm going to start this timeline about as early as you can. And so I started with Adam, in case there's any arguments about who was first. Everybody got one they can see? Up above. Any extras?
Is there going to be a test on this?
Yes.
This is on the test.
Are we out? That's about it. Boy, we could just get one to go
take
up above.
One to go up above.
Sure. So, starting at the beginning, we go between Adam and 1900 BC, Palestine occupied by various Semitic peoples, including Aramaeans and Canaanites, which included Canaan being a part of Palestine, Amorites, Moabites, Edomites, and Ammonites. Yes?
When did the term Palestine come in, though, that name?
Yes.
It wasn't called Palestine.
Well, certainly not in 1900 BC.
Right.
Because there, at that time, there weren't any people called Palestinians.
Right. So when did we get this term?
The term Palestine came into use primarily under the Romans, and then on into the Islamic period. It was known as the province of Palestine. So under the Romans, it was regarded as Palestine, and then on into the Islamic period, and from that time on to the present time.
I just think it's strange that we call it Palestine occupied at that time when it wasn't called that.
Well, the reason that I would use the term Palestine generically is because Israel today includes a part of the region, and if you want to incorporate areas like East Bank, up into southern Lebanon, you know, the boundaries changed. In other words, if you go back to Roman times or Islamic times, the boundaries were different than they are currently. So it's in terms of a historian's perspective, somebody who goes back and reads about history over the past several millennia, Palestine is a common designation. If you use the term Israel, then it creates problems because there wasn't an Israel from about 70 AD to the present time. So you see that poses problems. Now you could call it the southwestern part of Greater Syria. That would be maybe the other choice. I don't know, what other terms have you heard used to...
I didn't know, I just knew that the term Palestine came much later, and I wondered why we used that to refer to that area.
As I say, before the Romans used it as a province, it was alternatively referred to as, parts of it were Canaan.
Right.
There was another term used for the shore area. There were two terms used, one for the shore, one for the mountain area. you know, it was Israel for quite a few centuries, parts of it. So
so we just kind of do this as a historical...
Yeah, I mean, if you're studying history of the Middle East in general, Palestine is just a very common designation because it was used for by various political entities, Romans, Ottomans, Mamluks, Fatimids, you know, you can go through the dynasties. And that was the province name.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I know that today it's sort of a political thing.
Right.
If you say Palestine, but I mean, you got to call it something. And I think if we can, the thing about Israel is interesting is that Israel is very specific, you know, in terms of what it connotes. You know, it's a political entity and a people, you know, very specifically. Whereas Palestinian is a smorgasbord of people. And that's what this sort of shows you. As you go through here and you see from 1900 to 17 BC and 17 to 1240, and you see the waves of people who occupied the region, the different backgrounds, on into the modern day, where you had crusaders who lived there, and you have just people of different backgrounds, Egyptians and so on and so forth, all mixing together. And ultimately, anybody who lived there and spoke Arabic into the recent time was a Palestinian. See? And so that's why we have Christian Palestinians and Palestinians who have blue eyes and blonde hair. See? So this helps us to understand that we're not really talking about strictly the descendants of Ishmael versus the descendants of Isaac. That it isn't quite that simple. The Palestinian people are a great amalgam. And in fact, the Jewish people are as well. I mean, Jewish people have all kinds of mixing of blood. In fact, many of them mixed with non-Jewish people of the region. And so they all have common ancestors, in fact. So they're very, very close, if you want to talk about blood relations. And that's probably why Elias Shakur uses the term blood brothers. Because, in fact, they are. Any other comments on the timeline?
Well, I thought it all originated from Abraham, and then Hagar. Sarah, the one.
That's certainly referred to here in point two. You've got Abraham, who came into the region about 1900 B.C., and then he did have both Ishmael and Isaac. That's right.
And that's where they trace their, the rock and
Right. And of course, modern day Muslims, Arab Muslims, do think back to Ishmael as, the descendant of Abraham that they identify with. But as I say, there's been an awful lot of mixing going on. I almost feel that's more symbolic than reality. That Jewish people are a mix of both, various Semitic peoples, and Palestinians are a mix of various Semitic peoples. So if you want to talk about actual blood descent, it's very difficult to define, you see. Interestingly enough, Jewish people are Jewish by their mother, that is matriarchal descent, where Arabs generally are by paternal descent. So you could have an Arab Jew. See? If his mother's Jewish and his father's Arab, then he's both. See? Okay. So that's kind of the point of this, is to show that anybody who stands up and says, well, now here's the definitive historical reason why we own the land, is sort of, well, it's just not that simple. And so I think ultimately what we're left with as you go through the timeline and you get up to the modern day is the fact that, okay, Israel is there, it's there to stay, probably. Palestinians live there, they are there to stay, Arab, that is, Arab inhabitants. And so they're going to have to learn to get along. They're going to have to, there's going to have to be some kind of a compromise solution where all can have full rights in the region, everyone can have security, where people aren't going to be threatened because of their religious identity or their ethnic identity or historical connections. Everybody's going to have a place in this land, and that's ultimately my philosophy. And I think, as I said in my initial statements, that I think more and more the people in the region are recognizing this reality, that there's a kind of realism setting in, that no, the PLO is not going to cast Israel into the sea, as some of the early adherents said they would do. And likewise, they're not going to be able to ignore the fact that Palestinians are there and they need to be incorporated into the political life of the state of Israel, and something's got to be done for the citizens in the West Bank, I mean the people that live in the West Bank and have for a long time. The bottom of the first page, to look at Palestinian nationalism and Zionism as kind of parallel tracks. Before World War I, Zionism and Palestinian nationalism were just in infancy as far as modern political movements go. Zionism is a political term that refers to the drive to establish a modern-day Israeli state. And it is not, by the way, identical to the Israel of ancient history, because that Israel was a theocracy that was established around the Levitical priesthood that was appointed by God to be guardians of his temple and was entirely devoted to serving God. That was the ideal form of the ancient state of Israel. The modern state of Israel is a technically a democratic, secular state. See, you do not need to believe in God to be a citizen or to be a citizen in good standing. You understand what I'm saying? That it's a state in the modern sense of a nation state, which is democratic.
I am.
So those are two important, that's an important distinction.
Yeah, I talked with a Jewish gal. That was a very big surprise for me in some ways, because in the university was talking with a Jewish gal who said she was a Zionist, and I was trying to understand what that meant. She was Jewish, and she basically said she wasn't interested in all that religious stuff. She just wanted to see Israel established as a political entity in the region, and that she didn't really care about God. She wasn't interested in any of that, which surprised me, because as I think of Israel, you know, reestablishing the homeland and so on.
Well, 25% of the people in Israel are the religious people. 75% aren't very religious, are they?
I don't know that much about the specific breakdown within the Jewish community, but clearly there are a lot of factions, because if you look at the current government, you have a lot of small political parties, certain parties representing the very conservative Jewish position, some parties that until recently were Marxist. I mean, there's not a lot of movement now toward Marxism, so I think that party's probably shifting radically. But there's the sort of the labor side, and then there's the Likud side, and one is viewed as somewhat more conservative, some was somewhat more liberal. But this represents the great diversity of opinions in Israel, and it is a country of varied opinion and great diversity.
Now, where did they? Was that land given to them?
Well, okay.
Because Golda Meir's autobiography, she said they bought it.
Yeah. Well, that would be a bit simplistic to say. If you look at the timeline, you can get a real quick sense of what happened. Between World War I and 1947, the region was basically controlled by Britain. In 1917, the Balfour Statement came out. Lord Balfour wrote this statement, which promised a homeland for the Jewish people in the area. At the same time, it also indicated that the Palestinians wouldn't be displaced. So basically what Balfour did was try to please both sides and ended up mucking up the whole situation. Over the next several decades, the Palestinians who lived there refused to negotiate anything. They felt that they deserved to have an Arab homeland there and to be, in fact, part of a greater Arab state. And they refused to allow any concessions. And therefore, they ended up losing whatever leverage they had in the early days because they would not negotiate. And so, in the end, the immigrants, the Jewish immigrants to the area, were very well organized. They had planned ahead, and by 1948, when Britain was pulling out of the region, they were ready to establish a state. When Goldmayer refers to buying the land, what she means is that the immigrants who came into the area would purchase whatever land they could from local landholders or people who were maybe Egyptians who owned part of it. And
she said in every Jewish family all over the world, they had these little tin cans in the homes, and they put their extra pennies or whatever mm-hmm. it was that they helped pay, and mm-hmm. people think they took land away from the mm-hmm. Palestinians, whereas they bought it from...
Yeah, they were actually only able to purchase about 5% of the land by 1947. Yeah.
That was her idea.
Yeah, they were, you know, the local people, this was ancestral land, and they had a, you know, they were not very willing to just sell outright land that, you know, had been in their family for since about the 9th century. So they did purchase land that they could. They did develop land that had not been developed. They employed local Palestinians to help work on the land, and that is true as well. But, you know, the great line that a land without a people, for a people without a land, doesn't really fully explain the fact that, you know, the land wasn't really without a people, that there were people there. But I don't want to get into sort of placing blame at this point. My point is to simply explain that, you know, where we are now, and to try to move on from here as far as what are the possibilities for reconciliation, you know, down the road. And in any case, so we're kind of through the timeline. Any other comments on the timeline as far as... Now, you had a question about the PLO, and that was established in this early 60s when Arab states felt that the Palestinians needed to have a political voice. And I think the first meeting of the PLO was in Egypt under Nasser. Nasser was an Arab nationalist, and he you know, he was very anti-Israeli. And you had a comment?
Question. Mm-hmm. Did the Palestinians have any voice in choosing the people that represented them, the people of the PLO?
Well, they didn't really have a system for doing that. So, no, you couldn't say it was a freely elected body or something. Over the ensuing decades, the PLO managed to gain legitimacy in the eyes of a great many Palestinians. At the same time, it'd be hard to say, perhaps a third to a half. What's interesting is it's very often is not brought out in the media, is that opposing the PLO is the Muslim Brotherhood.
Also Palestinian.
Many of them Palestinian. But that, in other words, there's another dynamic going on, and that is that the people that want an Islamic revival and would like to see a pan-Islamic kind of society are threatened by nationalism. Because nationalism breaks up Arab people and Muslim people into various nation groups. And so the Islamic groups want to see a kind of return to Islam and a pan-Islamic movement. And the PLO stands for just the opposite, which is breaking into its own nation state, a secular state. The PLO is a secular organization, not Islamic. So these groups have been at odds for decades.
Now, is that the groups that are fighting each other in Lebanon?
No, those are other groups.
The plot thickens.
But in any case, I just want to clarify, the PLO was established with the support of Arab states to be a voice for the Palestinian people, to keep them on the front burner in the international situation, so that the Palestinians would have somebody, and eventually they did get in the UN, and so they would have somebody right there who could say, well, what about the Palestinians, and keep bringing up this question. They resorted to violence because from their point of view they were in a war, and so they did resort to violence. They ended up, I think, doing a lot of damage to themselves image-wise because they chose civilian targets. And this created a great animosity in the West, especially in the U.S., toward the PLO. I mean, the terms Palestinian and terrorist are almost always synonymous in the West. You know, a Palestinian in general is considered a terrorist. You see what I'm saying? Because of the PLO's attack on civilians. But in today's world, the PLO is a very different organization. It's, I think, really on the wane. It's losing influence. Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza feel like, well, you know, the PLO, while they had a lot of hope in that organization, is just not going to get the job done. And so people in the region, and particularly the youth, have become so frustrated with the PLO that they feel, well, we have to do another, have to go another way. So the Intifada, which has been going on for several years, was an expression of people inside the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and Israel saying, we're going to have to do something for ourselves. The Intifada, likewise, is kind of petering out. It's lost steam. And particularly with the Gulf War situation, where Iraq was so soundly defeated, as Joe Orlando, who was just here yesterday and today, said, he was in Jerusalem recently. He said the Palestinians that he met were just very depressed. He said they're more than in any time in recent years. They have a feeling of loss of all hope. They feel that they have no one to represent them. They have no cards to play. They're out of options. Now the irony is, this may be the time when they get some kind of state. I mean, as a result of being beaten down and right on the floor, now the international community comes in, and there's this peace conference in the works. It's funny how politics works. I mean, who would have thought that Sadat and Begin would be the first two guys to... I mean, they had a war together. They had a war. I mean, Sadat was the war hero in 73. So these two conservative arch enemies ended up being the first two to come together. So that's the funny thing about politics, is that when you least expect it, people that are supposed to be on totally opposite extremes end up coming together and forging a new kind of alliance.
Well, the Palestinians haven't really had a good leader. Arafat really hasn't been a good leader, has he? He really hasn't. He's played politics, but he hasn't.
Well, he's a survivor. You know, you have to give him that. I mean,
not
the guy has...
for himself.
Yeah, and I think that's what's happened now, is that he is beginning to lose popularity. I think what people are feeling is that he is kind of out of touch now with the modern-day reality. Mm-hmm. That he has been a figure for them, a real hero, but they don't have a lot of heroes to cheer about.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Yeah.
I mean, there aren't a lot of options, see, for them. He's a little more moderate than some of the more radical elements who to this day want to destroy the state of Israel. Arafat has come out and said he can work with Israel. And for some, this was a betrayal. And I'm sure they have a contract on his head because he did that. So he's accommodating, but he's getting old. He's probably near retirement age. And so, you know, they're looking to new leadership. But in any case, let's move on from there. I don't want to, let's wrap this up in 10 minutes and we'll solve the whole problem. Here's the three scenarios that we have. One, scenario A would be no change. Scenario B would be a worsening of the situation, and a scenario C would be improving. Anybody who's looking for a quick solution, look at the timeline and remind yourself of how long the dynamic of this area has been going on. There is not going to be a simple solution, a quick solution, but at least what we can look for are some trends and hope for option C. Option A would mean that there is no peace conference, or if there is, it's just a superficial thing and there's not really good faith negotiating. Israel would remain as it is, Palestinians would remain sort of without a voice and a subject people. Arab nations would remain unwilling to deal with Israel. Option B would either be a civil war internally with Palestinians within the boundaries of Israel and Gaza Strip and West Bank finally deciding we're going to have a war. They have never done that internally. The PLO's actions virtually always have been external. And the Intifada was strictly in the West Bank and Gaza. So there has never been an attempt by the Palestinians to have a guerrilla war within the borders of Israel. So that's a possible scenario with a whole new generation who feel like the South Africans, they don't have a voice. They could try to get weapons and start sabotaging and killing, and you know, there's a lot of violence today, but it could get worse. Externally, there could be a war if there was a switch in government in Syria, if there was a radicalization of Jordan or Egypt, and you know, there could possibly be another major conflict in the region. Frankly, I don't see that happening. Quite the opposite. My main point today is to try to see that these nations here have all kind of moved from a real idealistic kind of anti-Western position to a much more moderate kind of, well, we have to accommodate, we have to work with the U.S., we need to get on with the business of developing ourselves economically. So what I see happening in the region is that there's kind of a moderate quadrangle with Turkey, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. And the major factors are Soviet Union pulling out of the region and Iraq caving in. And those two factors are so significant that has just shifted the entire picture from a year and a half ago. A year and a half ago, Iraq was trying to drum up support for pressure on Israel, and that's just totally gone. There is no Arab state that has any interest now in pushing an anti-Israeli campaign. So I don't see another war on the horizon.
What about the pro-Jewish lobby that's very well organized in Congress and the economic gave that we give to Israel each year, which is very substantial.
Right. That dynamic has changed dramatically, because today people are saying, well, Saudi Arabia is our ally now, and this is a very important economic ally. And so, yes, Israel is our old friend, but this is where our bread is buttered. So economically, we need Saudi Arabia so much that this is having a heavy impact, I think, on domestic politics. And the other Gulf countries that are oil producing as well, these are our friends now. Egypt is a friend. So it's not quite as easy to just focus in on that relationship with Israel. And in fact, the current government, unlike any administration I can recall, has made some very kind of, I wouldn't say threats, but they have made some rather grim sort of hints about what they might do with aid to Israel. And I think Israel is very, very concerned. Very concerned. Yes, they came out of the war looking, they're happy that Iraq is not a threat, but they also now are more obligated to the U.S. And so they're not as sort of invulnerable anymore, and they aren't on their own anymore. They're tied in.
Well, isn't it also what they do with the money that we give? They're building more on the West Bank. And
the settlements, yes. Bush himself has said the settlements are right now the chief stumbling block. They're a part of the bigger picture. And this is one of the main negotiating issues. If there's a conference, the things that they're going to have to negotiate primarily are land, settlements, and Jerusalem. Oh well, also, they'll have to negotiate security for Israel. So those are the four biggies that will be negotiated if there's a peace conference.
Where is there a spot over there, if they do establish a Palestinian state, where is there a place over there that they could establish it that would be enough to
Would it be viable?
That would support that population. That's a big population.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. If there was no outside influence here, if the U.S., if the Soviet Union were totally out of the picture, there was no money coming into the region, then all of these states would be forced to become more interdependent. And I think that's really what the U.S. is starting to think about. That if, you know, Israel exports a lot of fruit, a lot of vegetables, a lot of agricultural products, also a lot of high-tech stuff. If they needed to export directly to these countries, they do, you know, by the way.
In Kuwait, we got great produce, and we discovered it. I think it was all labeled from Cyprus, but basically it came out of Israel, was sent to Cyprus, reboxed in boxes from Cyprus, and sold in Kuwait. And yet, in Kuwait, we couldn't use the word Israel. When our pastor preached, he had to refer to it as, you know that place, or occupied Palestine. So we, and our visa specifically said the bearer of this passport, on our Kuwaiti visa, said the bearer of this passport, if they were to enter Israel, their visa to Kuwait would be null and void. So you know, there was all this set up, but yet they got their bulk of their produce from Israel.
The fact that Syria was willing to go along with the U.S. peace process is very, very significant, because Syria has housed a lot of the guerrilla groups, and so you sense that there's a real moderating of the nation states now. Underlying that is the question, do these governments represent the people? Are the people happy with what their governments are doing? Well, that may not be important in these countries because, in a sense, the people aren't usually represented by these governments. That is, the people don't really expect the government to fully represent them anyway. But You just sense that if Syria can moderate, then, things can begin to develop. So these are the things that are going to need to be negotiated. Israel doesn't want to negotiate Jerusalem, and they don't want to see the PLO involved in any way. And I think they may get away with not having the PLO involved. But ultimately, let me just summarize it this way. I think what could happen is that the West Bank, your question was where, the West Bank and Gaza, which is where the concentration of them are.
But could that support a population that way?
Well, this was my other point when I mentioned the economic interdependence, is they'll have to be interdependent, see? They will be interdependent. They will have a lot of economic ties. Gaza provides the laborers for Israel. And so they'll have to be very heavily interconnected. So the point is they'll have their own area where they can control it politically, but economically they'll all be part of the same organic region. You see? That's what has to happen. Okay? And then possibly Jerusalem will become an international city, an international sort of zone protected by the UN.
I know we're out of time, but what about the war-torn country, which is adjacent, which is Lebanon? I mean, that's got to be a stickler.
Okay, well, why don't we, let's talk a little bit about that, but let's stop the discussion on the Palestinian-Israeli issue, and then people can leave and we can shut off the tape. And then if you want to stay for a few minutes and talk about that, we can. I'm sorry we didn't get sort of...
They also rang the bell early.
A lot more. As far as Lebanon, what was your question about Lebanon?
Well, you know, yeah, I think it's where you're headed.
Well, you know, actually Lebanon, things have changed dramatically in Lebanon. The government of Lebanon has sort of... reestablished itself very much along the lines of what it was pre-75. You have an equal-sized Christian and Muslim representation in the parliament, and they have a formula where the president is Muslim and the prime minister is Christian, and the government, the army has reasserted itself, and they have virtually now controlled all of the regions that were controlled by various militia, except for South Lebanon, which is a buffer zone of Israel. And eventually that'll come back under Lebanon's control. So
in the realm of what, 10,
15 years. But it's the last 6 months have seen a significant change. There's been an awful lot less of that, and I'll tell you why. It's because Lebanon has finally agreed to become kind of under Syria's wing. And Syria has gotten what it wants, which is control, a kind of big brother kind of control over Lebanon. And this is what Syria has wanted all along, is a greater Syria. And so Syria has been a very important influence in the guerrilla movements and supporting various groups. And, you know, Syria occupied Lebanon for about 10 years. So now that Syria is satisfied, they've gotten most of what they want except for the Golan Heights.
Well, I always thought it was amazing you could stand and look at the Mediterranean and turn around and see total devastation.
Yeah.
This must be incredible, having not been there, but we do have television and pictures and satellite technology that transfers things almost instantaneously.
Well, yeah, Lebanon used to be we talked to friends who were missionaries in the Middle East, and they all used to go to Lebanon to lie on the beaches. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were supposed to be just the pearl of the Mediterranean.
The main sticking point in Lebanon today is the Shia. See, going back to the way things were in 74 doesn't solve the problem of the poorest segment of Lebanese, which is the Shia, and they're still left out politically. So until somebody addresses their needs and says, well, okay, we'll include you in the political process, they may continue to hold hostages, they may continue to carry on some...
I was going to say, if we see some reconciliation between Israel and the movement of the hostage issue, that things might move pretty quickly there.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And of course, then what follows immediately is U.S. and Iran ties being reestablished. Yeah.
Give us some aid.
Yeah, you got a comment. Go ahead.
I got to go do the kids. We're
going to. I'm going to dishes.
You're doing dishes
yeah.
tonight?
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
What effect is this?
Let's talk longer so I don't have to do dishes.
This
so.
Enormous war effort that the Western world, I mean, the Saudis.
Yeah, the Gulf War, yeah.
What effect has that had on maybe a serious. I mean, when they saw how much we just completely smashed.
Right, right.
What effect has that had on them?
Well, I think that's why they're all being rather pragmatic, you know, because the way I put it, in today's world, the U.S. is, from their perspective, the U.S. is the great empire of the world. I had one Arab student say, "Yeah, you know, well, every generation, every era needs an empire, and you know, you had Rome, and you had the Ottomans, and now you have the U.S. And that's okay with him." You know, it's like, well, you got to have an empire somewhere to keep order. So he sort of accepted the idea that we're the police person of the world. Now, we don't like to think of ourselves that way, but that's how we're perceived. And it's sort of interesting.